Welcome to the Far and Beyond podcast, hosted by the Contracts and Fiscal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. This podcast is for the federal government attorney navigating the complex intersection of acquisitions and fiscal law and policy. I am your host, Major Ellie Sewell.
I'm Major Jason Floyd.
And I'm Major Ken Muniz. Today, we are tackling an invisible part of the battlefield, intellectual property. All right, so over the last year, we've heard a lot about continuous transformation, right? And how the future fight is unknown and we need to change how we do business. With that comes the advent of stuff like software-defined hardware, AI-enabled weapon systems, and 3D printing at the tactical edge.
Exactly. So we're moving from the era of buying a tank and sitting on it for 40 years to an era where the weapon has code that updates every week. So navigating this transformation means that judge advocates need to know intellectual property.
That's right. So picture it. Sicily, 19, just kidding. That's a tribute to the Golden Girls. Did you guys watch that show growing up?
Thank you for being a friend.
There you go.
Yeah, no, I've never seen it.
So you're going to start quoting Golden Girls, but you don't know Pirates of the Caribbean.
That's accurate. Yeah.
Okay. I just want to clarify.
Oldie but goodie, not newbie but terrible. I don't know. So picture it, right? So imagine a commander asking if they can patch a targeting system with some sort of script that a warrant officer wrote while in the motor pool, or picture a supply sergeant 3D printing parts and giving them out like they're candy to the soldiers that need to fix their equipment.
So that sounds like a minefield, and I'm also not even sure what you might have just said. So not only am I trying to decipher that issue of what you're even talking about, but then I'm also wondering, are we breaking federal law by doing that, by doing 3D printing and printing something out? You know, who owns the script that they're writing? And what does 3D printing mean for IP infringement?
Well, the good news is that no one is going to jail for that, probably. I'm a lawyer. I don't speak in absolutes, right? I don't remember learning about IP jail. However, to keep the DOW out of billion-dollar liability claims, the JAG School is starting to educate the force on IP and related issues, which brings us to today.
Yeah, so actually, there are criminal penalties associated with, like, the theft of trade secrets, for example. But yeah, like, nobody's going to, like, IP jail, like you said. So the biggest concern for us is the liability that you talked about. And Ellie, I think you're right to worry. We do want innovation at that tactical edge. But there's a bunch of IP statutes out there, and they were generally written for authors and inventors, not necessarily for AI models or rapid prototyping on the battlefield. So if we don't get this legal advice right, we might violate our contracts, or we could be facing multi-million or even multi-billion dollar claims.
Isn't being locked into a single vendor also an IP issue, though? Like when we buy a system, but we can't fix it or upgrade it because the contractor owns the data, right?
You got it. That's another concern, right? So not just are we violating someone's rights, but if we own the hardware, but we don't have the keys to the software, that could be a problem. So our job today, as I see it, is really to explain what those keys are. But in future episodes, because this is sort of like a mini series of sorts, we'll talk about more in depth about what those keys are and how to even get access to those things through different contract vehicles.
But before we get to the contracts themselves, can you tell the audience a little bit about IP generally, right? And then IP law, like which statutes matter to our practice?
Yeah, Hyun, that's a great setup, right? So let's talk about the kinds of IP. So generally there's four buckets, right? Or four kinds of IP protections. You got patents, copyrights, trademarks, and trade secrets. We don't really talk about trademarks when we talk about government acquisitions. We do have trademarks and we have trademark issues that we run into, but we're not like buying trademarks or licensing trademarks, that kind of stuff. So for now, we'll just skip all that one entirely.
Yeah, I agree. We can skip trademarks because really when you're talking trademarks, we're talking about like the use of the Air Force logo or the Army logo or something of that nature. And that's really not going to fall into our acquisition and fiscal law area, which is what we're discussing today.
You got it. Yeah. So let's just start with patents then. So patents, generally, we're talking about Title 35 of the U.S. Code. When you hear patents, you think about inventions, right? That's what a patent right protects is the invention. So machines, processes, hardware, and the rights scheme is known as a limited monopoly. When you have a patent right, we say you have a limited monopoly. So if you invent a new recoil system for a weapon, and you disclose it to the public, the government then gives you the right to exclude others from practicing the invention. That essentially means making it, using it, selling, or importing it for a period of about 20 years, depending on the kind of patent. And then there are different types of patents like plants or designs. But when the Army buys stuff, it's generally buying what's called a utility patent. We want useful things, and so, you know, it's a utility patent. We're not looking for seeds or some sleek user interface that we might come across when we have either a plant patent or a design patent.
Okay, I think I got that with patents. So I think the next on your list was copyrights.
That's right. Weren't you like a arts major?
Film studies.
Oh, sorry.
Hey, I enjoyed my film studies time. It has helped me create and understand how to make a podcast.
That's right. And you're very good at it.
Yes. Thank you. I did study film studies in undergrad, so I know a bit about this stuff and copyright laws. Protect, you know, the original expression when it's fixed to a tangible medium. And so what we mean is like books, photographs, artwork, even manuals. And then interesting enough, it actually covers computer code.
So it wasn't actually obvious to me that computer code is copyrightable, but I guess it can be original and it technically is fixed in a tangible medium, right?
You got it. Yeah, source code is a great example of how copyrights have evolved in the face of technology. We definitely did not have that back in the revolutionary period when we started thinking about how to protect creations of the mind like a copyright. So yeah, software is a fantastic modern example of what is copyrightable or potentially copyrightable. And then finally, that third bucket, trade secrets, right? This is information that has value because it is not generally known to the public. The Coca-Cola formula, KFC's 13 herbs and spices or whatever it is, those are pretty famous examples. But in our world, it might be the specific algorithm or the weights that an AI model uses or the detailed way that a company manufactures the drone, like the heat, the temperature at which it welds the joints or whatever it is, right? That might be a trade secret.
So contractors love trade secrets because they never expire as long as they stay secret.
That's right. And that can be bad for us, not always, right? But it can be bad if it creates what's often called a black box problem. So they deliver a weapon, it works for us, you know, for as long as we want it to, but then we don't really know how it works. And if it breaks, we have to rely entirely on the original equipment manufacturer, or what we call the OEM, to fix it.
And I know we have federal law, but what about state laws? Do we need to be worried about state law even though we are the federal government?
So patent laws are almost entirely federal, and for our purposes, they really are. States have a minor role in regulating some license rights with respect to state law transactions, but those don't really concern our practice. So the other kinds of IP each have a mix of federal and state law that have something to say about sort of everything. So for example, the state law really drives the train on trade secrets, as most states have adopted what's called the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, or the UTSA. And that provides a civil remedy for misappropriation, while federal law supplements that. It really relies on the state law interpretations because the federal law is relatively new. And so what is actually defined to be a state secret is really a creature of state law.
Okay, so that's the four kinds of IP generally. When I'm reviewing a contract for a new drone system, I'm looking at FAR and DFAR's clauses. Where can I find the patent clauses and the copyright clauses, the trade secrets, all of that?
Yeah, so this is where practitioners in the field might get tripped up. We've been talking about patents, copyrights, trade secrets, but we didn't say anything about data rights. That's because the term data rights is really an umbrella term for taking a license to the information relating to a copyright's IP, right?
Fantastic summary, Hyun. So yeah, you got it. In government contracting, we generally don't own the IP, right? We don't take title to it. The contractor gets to keep the title nowadays, at least. And so what we do is we buy a license to that. So this is mostly true even when we pay for the development. Not always true. There's some nuance there that we'll skip over that we might cover in future episodes. But for now, Congress took the federal government out of the business of owning most IP about 50 years ago. So the FAR and the DFARS defines all of the information related to those IP protection and brackets it into what we call data, right? So we'll get into data rights specifically in a future episode. But for now, it's just important that if you're looking for those clauses that you talked about, Ellie, you're going to be looking for data rights clauses, generally speaking.
Yeah, for now, it's important to recognize that you shouldn't go looking for trade secret clauses. When we're licensing data, look for information about data right clauses in FAR Part 27 and DFARS 227. Licensing can get kind of tricky.
Yeah, I remember reviewing a bunch of commercial license agreements. It can get rough.
Yeah, it can get super tricky, and I think that's why we should save it for a future episode on like how to actually do those specially negotiated licenses.
Okay, so let's dig into those earlier examples. A warrant officer and supply sergeant. Does a soldier own any IP rights if she uses the unit's 3D printer to invent a new thing that improves an existing piece of equipment, or write some software patch to fix a glitch, or add a feature to an existing device? How do I get this soldier? This soldier is like on it.
Yeah, how do you get this soldier? The Army is trying to answer that question. I love the dual examples because they sort of highlight the difference between patents and copyrights. First, I'll say that this is obviously not legal advice and there's probably a lot of facts that need to be added, right? Like this is not specifically contracting because we're not acquiring goods or services from the soldier itself, right? Like they're an employee of the agency. So putting aside all those issues, right? First, we have to think about whether, a patent exists and then how do we get those rights? So first thing is, the new thing that improves this existing piece of equipment, right, that the soldier is making, that's probably patentable. And so skipping a whole lot of law again, but generally anything new, useful, and non-obvious or new and useful improvement there too is patentable. However, after Executive Order 10,096, way back in the day, I think it was like 1949, 1950, and the relevant Army regulation, if a soldier used government time, facilities, or equipment, in this case, it would be the Army's 3D printer, the Army owns the title to that invention. So if the soldier wants to sell it to the Army, she can't. Moreover, the Army cannot be sued later by her, say if she gets out of the Army and tries to sue the Army for patent infringement. The Army can't be sued in that case because, again, the Army owns the title.
So Army takes the title. Dang.
Yeah, that seems exactly like what is happening in a lot of innovation competitions, although each one might have its own rules, right? I have heard that the Air Force is at least paying out some cash prizes or royalties for licenses.
Air power.
Oh, Lord.
Anyways, so what about that software patch?
Yeah, so a little different, right? Because that's a copyright issue, potentially. Works created by U.S. government employees as part of their official duties or at the request of government officials generally cannot be copyrighted because those are what are known as government works. So there's really no title to own there.
So the soldier can't own it either. It just falls into the public domain.
If it's public domain, can she post it online?
So it depends, right? Though it's not subject to copyright, that doesn't mean it's not protected information. We all know about all the ways in which information could be deemed controlled unclassified information, CUI. So a software patch that fixes our system could be deemed CUI, and so that information could also be subject to export control laws or the International Trafficking in Arms Regulation, all that stuff. So it can get really tricky. So even though it may not be subject to IP protection, that doesn't mean that the soldier can just do whatever he or she wants with it.
Okay, listen, not everyone has an IP counsel in their unit, so who am I calling if I have issues? No, it's
is
right
that a
here.
Ghostbusters joke?
Yeah, who are you gonna call?
Yeah, fantastic. No, you're right. You're right. There's not too many IP attorneys in the Department of War, and lots of them are at organizations where judge advocates are not. And so, for the Army's largest buyer of intellectual property, which is Army Materiel Command, there are about 16 or so, I think, last I counted. One of them is at the headquarters there, and then a few are spread out among subordinate commands like TACOM or AMCOM. Most of those are advising programs, though, and so in the Army, we don't have a lot of judge advocates at those locations. Otherwise, I think we just have one at the headquarters of the newly established T2COM, and I'm not sure if there are any within what is now Western Hemisphere Command. We do have CLIP, though, the Contract Litigation and Intellectual Property Division within USALSA, that handles IP litigation, and they're super helpful. And finally, we have the IP cadres up at the department levels, both at the Department of War and each of the services.
I think the Air Force is similar. Most of our IP attorneys are civilians. Judge advocates are not really advising on these matters, so we're finding new issues arising all the time.
Okay, I have a question. what is the IP cadre? Like, I know they're IP experts, but what do they do?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, actually, Hyun. So the IP cadre was mandated by Congress at the Department of War level almost 10 years ago. The statute mandated that DoD put together a team to advise the department on all things in IP in government acquisitions, from program management to engineering, logistics, fiscal law, even IP valuation, which is a tricky subject, right? How much is IP really worth, and are we overpaying or underpaying? All that stuff. And once the DoW put together the team, the military departments, or the MILDEPs, formed their own cadres. So these folks are in charge of advising the department or the services on what the DoW's policies and regulations should be with respect to IP and how to implement IP law into government contracts. They're incredibly useful and super helpful, but they're also really busy. They just released a rewrite to DFARS Part 227, and it's pretty substantial. So to the extent you can reach out to your local IP practitioner, either at T2Com or maybe Western Hemisphere Command's going to get one, or maybe even the friendly folks at AMC, you should reach out to those first.
All right. Thank you, Jason, for explaining IP Law 101. I know I can speak for probably a lot of people who are listening. This is just not an area we're familiar with, but it seems to be a very big hot topic that is starting to pop up more and more, especially as we're trying to acquire new technology, new systems. I think this is really important that we do understand at least the basics and know what to look out for, so we then know, okay, we need to call in someone who might have a little bit more expertise in this area.
And maybe one day you, our listeners, will become those people who everybody calls.
Who are you going to call?
God help us.
Da-da-na-na-na-na.
Thank you for joining us today in this episode of Far and Beyond. Please make sure to follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We love to hear from our listeners, so please continue to reach out to us on Facebook and LinkedIn. The information can be found in the show notes from today's episode. The views expressed today are those of the presenters, not that of the Judge Advocate General Corps, the Department of the Army, the Department of the Air Force, or the Department of War.